I'd like to call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum here, and we do have minutes from the last meeting that we do have to approve. Representative McNamara, would you like to approve the...
I sure would.
Thank you. Move to approve the meeting, meeting minutes. Representative McNamara moves to approve the meeting minutes from the last committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. Today, we're going to continue on with the overviews that we've been hearing. We did have the overview from the DNR last week, and we're going to be starting off today with the Board of Soil and Water Resources, Bowser. And Mr. Jasky is going to be presenting to us today. And welcome, Mr. Jasky. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm John Jasky. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and I appreciate the invitation to come here today and provide you with an overview of our agency and our endeavors. In your packet, you'll have a copy of the materials that I'm going to speak from. There's also a couple of supplemental materials that are in your packets that you may want to refer to at some point in time, either today or later on. I also want to introduce Julie Crocker. She's sitting over here to my left. She's our Assistant Director, and she helped me prepare this presentation, and she will be in front of you on various issues as we go forward in the session, and I'm sure you'll get a chance to see her either collectively in committee or individually during meetings that we have on particular matters. So with that, I'll begin if you're ready, Mr. Chairman. I'll begin with our mission statement is to improve and protect Minnesota's water and soil resources by working in partnership with local organizations and private landowners. And we do that through our local government network, and I will talk more about that in a few minutes. This map here is a diagram which shows the land ownership in the state of Minnesota and includes the list of currently impaired waters. And you can see that many of those impairments are focused in areas where we have a lot of high private land ownership. And so we need to do projects and programs working with private landowners to improve those water resources. And so our focus is on those local organizations and the private landowners that they connect with. That map shows that 78% of land is in private land ownership, and that we rely on our local government as that principal land use authority and the ones who have the greatest and most direct connection with our citizens, the landowners and citizens that need to all be involved in improving our clean water efforts and also our conservation efforts. Our focus is on conservation, clean water, and wetland programs, projects, and practices in a variety of different ways through a variety of different statutory authorities. We have an organization that has a board that is appointed by the governor. There are 9 local government representatives on that board, and they use this as their primary vehicle for their ideas and input to state policy as it relates to clean water and conservation. They represent county commissioners, soil and water conservation district supervisors, and watershed district managers. We also have 3 citizens, and we have the 5 agencies that also sit on our board: DNR, Pollution Control, Department of Agriculture, Department of Health, and the University of Minnesota, which brings in that scientific and research perspective. We're a small agency. We have about 75 staff and 8 offices around the state. The bulk of our staff is in our regional offices, and you can see there the number of local governments that we have a statutory responsibility to utilize to carry out our conservation and clean water mission. I won't go through this list. We'll go through these in some detail in a few slides down the road, but there's a list of statutory responsibilities and citations there at some point that you may need to refer back to. First, I'll highlight the soil and water conservation districts. There are 91 of them across the state. They have been in existence since this federal law was passed back in 1935, the Soil Conservation and Domestic Allotment Act of 1935, and since then they've been forming these districts across the state and across the nation, for that matter, to deal with those very specific things that are listed there in the very beginnings of that statute citation, which you see there at the bottom of the slide. If you're interested in more details about what any one of them is up to and doing, you can see more about that on our website. There's also a publication there that has been printed in a limited fashion that describes the activities that each one of them have been undertaking for the last several years. The watershed districts are special purpose governments formed to deal with water quantity or quality issues, and primarily they're established to deal with water across the geopolitical boundaries. You can see that watershed districts have been formed across county lines in most every case. Many of them were formed to do flood control projects, some were formed to do water quality projects, and some were created to do a combination of the two. You can see in the metropolitan area we have watershed districts that also work in concert with the water management organizations, which are joint powers authorities that manage on a watershed basis. We also have, again, if you're interested, a guidebook on our website that was also published recently. It will be published again here this year that updates you on the specific activities of each of those watershed districts. And we also oversee the operations of counties as it relates to their water management authorities. Each county in the state has chosen to establish a local water management plan. And here's an example of the cover page from Stearns County. Mind you, these plans are developed with lots of citizen input. They bring the science and the citizens together to develop a plan of action for their area across a wide variety of issues. Everything from agriculture to recreation to urban landscapes and so on and so forth. But they bring in the input from various agencies, from various scientific findings. They bring the citizens together to craft a plan of action for their community. And you see this picture of the front cover, but the really important part of these plans is the back of these plans, where it lays out an implementation schedule, a list of projects and programs and activities that they're going to undertake for that time period. And I should point out that involves quite a few different organizations in many cases. It includes the cities, it includes a lot of the nonprofit groups, and it includes a lot of the conservation-minded organizations that focus on that local community. On the lower right-hand side of the screen is that list of authorities that manage water on a watershed basis in the metropolitan area. We have a special law that was created back in the mid-1980s that required that cities, in joint fashion with watershed districts, manage water on a watershed basis. The reason for that was that we had some problems with one city pushing all of their water down to the next city without any means to manage that issue, stormwater being a particular concern at the time. Certainly now we have water quality issues also that have played into the more recent efforts to manage across those city boundaries. As I mentioned, all of these programs and these local governments, they're really managing on a watershed basis, and you'll hear more about that as one of the trends that we're seeing happening, not just in the metropolitan area, but across the entire state. And you can see some examples of different aspects of managing a watershed, which include a variety of land uses and certainly outcomes that result from pushing water downstream. The scale of these watershed approaches varies greatly. You can see on the right-hand side, we've got a plan of action for how to deal with the hypoxia problem in Gulf of Mexico, where we have nutrients that are generating excess amounts of plant growth and disturbing the ecosystem in the Gulf of Mexico. But then we also have plans that are much smaller in scale, but just as important, which is the local plans that communities develop in concert with the agencies to craft both the science and the analysis and then the action plan for how to clean up our impaired waters. These are the tools that the local governments use, and they all basically fall into one of these categories. And you see that they start with step zero, because step zero is reflective of the fact that we don't actually accomplish anything on the ground, but we set the stage for what should be done, how it should be done, and how it can be done most cost effectively. So data collection, analysis, and development of these plans is critical. But again, we don't actually change anything on the land until we get to steps 1, 2, and 3. And these are the tools that in some combination with the analysis are what these local governments utilize to deal with clean water and conservation and connect that to their citizenry. And then, of course, once you do these things in some fashion, you need to go back and analyze how well they've been working. So you kind of start in a continuous loop back again, looking at the data, looking at the analysis, and then adjusting as needed. I'll start with a more local scale. Here's an example of just one component of a local plan. You can see that they get quite detailed in their analyses, and they get into very specific things about what kinds of projects and what places on the land those projects need to be done to be most effective. Here's an example of an inter-county plan, two counties joining together to manage a watershed. This is one that I happen to have some responsibility for in my prior position, and Representative McNamara probably knows where that fish in the lower right is probably still swimming, but you can see that land use is even in an area like this, fairly small, relatively to the state of Minnesota size anyway, has a variety of issues in land uses, from agriculture to urban development to suburban development, and certainly recreation being a high component of that as well, all of it focused on that watershed. A little bit larger scale yet, you see an example of how critical it is to coordinate water management in the state. Here's the Red River Valley Basin in the Minnesota side, and in that part of the state we have watershed districts that have gotten together to plan how they're going to stage and locate their projects so that they can control flooding on the main stem of the river. It's been an issue up there, as you know, for many decades, and they've done basin-wide analysis to determine where they ought to be putting projects in relationship to each other so that they can coordinate the impacts of the flood peaks on the main stem. Here's that same basin, but looking at the whole basin. It includes both the Minnesota side on the right-hand side there, and the North Dakota, South Dakota, and the two provinces, or the province as well. And we know that this Red River flows north into Lake Winnipeg, and we have an international issue here with both water quality and quantity. The city of Winnipeg has spent many hundreds of millions of dollars building a flood diversion project around the city, but they've also got water quality issues in Lake Winnipeg. So we have a basin commission that's been established in this part of the state to deal with these interstate and international issues. Now I'm going to get into some of the more specific program responsibilities. The first one I'll highlight is the Wetland Conservation Act. This law has been in place since early 1990s to protect our existing wetlands. And it has a no-net loss policy that's been established and adhered to throughout that time. It also, the policy of the state is to increase the quality and quantity of our and biological diversity of our wetlands. And to do that by avoiding impacts to wetlands, and both can't avoid impacts to wetlands because of certain developments, that we replace those wetland functions somewhere else. And we'll talk more about how that gets done. We have a variety of responsibilities under this law. We here at Administrative Appeals, we have technical responsibilities to make decisions in the field. We coordinate with the state and federal agencies, including some of our own responsibilities on enforcement. We administer the rules for the program. In fact, we have a rule amendment process that's now nearing its completion based on some statute changes that were made 2 years ago, and that process is moving forward. We have training and certification responsibilities to make sure that the folks that are doing the work have the proper training and credentials. And we also review and approve local ordinances that go, in some cases, above and beyond what the state standard has been set to be. And finally, we mitigate wetlands for the public road authorities in the state, and do that as part of a wetland bank that we've established that allows persons who are impacting wetlands to buy credits from someone who has chosen to restore or create a wetland for that purpose elsewhere. We have lots of process and certainly important parts of due process for landowners who are affected or part of these regulations. We have processes for parties to appeal and so forth, and not all of this, or maybe very much of it at all, gets used in most cases, but there are processes in place to assure enforcement and due process is adhered to. In the field, we have our local governments and our experts having kind of two functions that they do on a regular basis. One is they have to determine the wetland edge, and that's called wetland delineation, and we have manuals and training that accomplishes that. They're looking at these three parameters of the hydrology, the plants, and the soils. And if you can see in this picture, the hydrology is ephemeral in many cases, and so determining where a wetland edge is in any given day or any given year, regardless of the circumstances that they see, is a critical responsibility that our local governments and our staff carry out. We also have a responsibility to assess wetland function when we have an impact to a wetland that has to occur, and we have to replace it somewhere else. We have to make sure we have a no-net loss of wetland functions. And so wetland functional assessment is also a part of those field responsibilities. Wetland mitigation, that's the replacement of wetlands that have had impacts under the statute. You can see that in the lower left there's a wetland that's probably is going to be at risk long-term because of it no longer being in a sustainable area. So those types of sites are often mitigated or replaced elsewhere. And as I mentioned before, we have the responsibility to replace the wetland impacts that occur from development. Public water authorities being one of the primary projects that we end up seeing, having no other way than to actually impact the wetland where the road already, what road corridor is, or the most preferable alternative for a new route. And we have a responsibility to make sure that these sites are well designed and maintained and monitored so that they're in perpetuity going to replace the wetlands that have been permanently lost. And so we have a program to help create the best wetland we can and the best in the site available, as well as make sure that it remains and is sustainable in perpetuity. And we use legal work as well as on the ground work to accomplish that. Wetland Bank, not really exciting pictures to show, certainly, but it's a database that allows users who need wetland credits to get in contact with and purchase credits from those who restored or built a wetland for that very purpose. It's really an entrepreneurial endeavor that allows that wetland to be created and restored in advance, so we know exactly how well it's performing, and at some point down the road allow debits from the credits established by that new wetland to offset impacts that otherwise would have very difficult time doing that same kind of thing, just offset those wetland functions. So you have a 10-acre wetland that gets restored, and that would allow then, you know, a number of smaller increments of wetland impacts to substitute for that. So it's a banking program that's been in place for now about 15 years, and we also use this to fulfill the requirements of the Federal Clean Water Act, which has a similar set of circumstances for mitigation of wetlands.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know why the map looks like that, where the bank wetlands are where they are, and then there's that kind of circle where there's a deficit of wetlands?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, this map shows the balance of credits in each of those, we call them bank service areas, and really watershed basis. You can probably tell by the lines. We're trying to align the science with the replacement of the wetlands of the regulatory program. Our goal over time is to try and achieve a balance, right? To have not a surplus or a deficit, but to have a balance. But that over time, we try and manage that. And at any given moment, you're going to have a surplus in one area and a deficit in the other. But I just wanted to show you that we track it based on those kinds of criteria.
So do you have to trade within the watershed?
Director Jasky.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Everett, it's a very good question. We do. The statute and the federal regulations require that you trade basically when those dark lines, those larger areas, with a preference for trading first in those smaller watershed-based areas. Very good question. Thank you. Some recent highlights, I mentioned a few of these. We've got a rulemaking effort that is underway, and it's currently all for public. We'll be all for public notice here in another couple of weeks, we expect. We've done a very large and long informal process to get public input already, and now the formal process begins under the Administrative Procedures Act. We have an agreement with MnDOT to replace wetlands for road authorities across the state together with them, and we basically achieve that by them participating in our wetland banking program. We have an agreement with the Army Corps of Engineers, which is completed now, on how to allow the state statute to fulfill these federal mitigation and regulatory components. That gives landowners a much more straightforward approach to getting projects reviewed and approved. We are working on an agreement with the U.S. Department of Agriculture because in the farming areas of the state, they have what's known as the swamp buster provision of the Federal Farm Bill, which has some protections for wetlands in that. And one of the challenges we've had is that we used to be able to coordinate fairly well, but some of the more recent farm bills have prevented public access to the information. And so we're coming up with ways to bridge that requirement to keep that information only in the hands of landowners. We still will work through the landowners. They're the ones that are going to have to be interested in participating, but we've got a lot of, I think, ideas of late that we can work with from the farm groups as well as the USDA folks to help that along. So we're working on that. We've just begun that effort. And finally, we've used some funding from previous appropriations to do an inventory of wetland restoration opportunities in the northeastern part of the state, where we've got a lot of wetlands already, and obviously a lot of wetland impacts that occur from large-scale endeavors such as mining and other types of projects.
And Director Jaski, I know that there's been some controversy over exactly when you're doing inventory how to calculate what is a wetland and what isn't. I don't know if you want to elaborate on that a little bit. I know that there are some who feel that not all wetlands are being included in the counts. And I've talked to a number of individuals that have been concerned about that. And I don't know if you've got any opinions to express on that matter.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, one of the things that has been standardized much more of late is the methods on the ground to determine where a wetland is and where its edge is, that delineation that I talked about. We're also using remote technology much more of late because it's getting better. The aerial imagery is getting better. And in some cases, we can make estimates using that technology, but for regulatory purposes, we actually have to do it on the ground in most every case because that's where you get the anomalies that sometimes you can't see with the aerial imagery.
Okay. And also, I think there's some issue about wetlands that have been created. There are newly created wetlands that are being added to the inventory.
Mr. I think I understand. Yeah, you're the issue of trying to measure known net loss is one thing that comes up all the time. You know, how do we measure that? And that's where we do have some efforts underway, interagency efforts, to try and do a more consistent and more precise job of measuring that known net loss. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service does that as well to some extent, but their methods are a much grosser scale because they're doing it across the whole country. We've got a couple of efforts underway in Minnesota to be more precise at that, and I can probably give you more details at a later opportunity.
Okay, thank you.
Our conservation cost share program is one where it's really targeting projects. Most of them are fairly small scale, but they're projects where we work with landowners, private landowners in most cases, to do a project that involves their contribution. Often it involves a contribution from the USDA. If we can work it out, we leverage some federal funding to bring into the picture as well. We do this by using those plans to pick priority areas and projects, and we have some regional centers that we've established with engineering and technical design capacity to help get those projects onto the ground. Here's some kinds of problems that they typically would deal with. The upper left there's some erosion that's occurring, and probably need to put some kind of a waterway structure in there, shape it and feed it into some kind of native vegetation that will last and can tolerate the water flowing over its surface. Maybe some soil amendments are required as well. The lower left there, you see a picture of a area that flooded into a field, and that may be an opportunity to talk with the landowner and put in a riparian buffer to allow the flood water to flow over that area without damaging the crop and taking the soil with it. In the lower right, you see an area that's a riparian area, obviously, that's got a feedlot or a feeding area for this farming operation, and we've worked with many landowners to fence off the area next to the riparian site and establish a more controlled area where the animal livestock are able to be fed and sometimes transported across from one part of their property to another. On the upper right, there's a wetland restoration that's being undertaken there, but you can kind of see those little people. I guess they're average-sized people, but they're small in this picture, working in the background. And what they're trying to do is get rid of the reed canary grass. Reed canary is an invasive species, and they're using these sprayers to try and get that plant community out of there before we go in and actually put the native vegetation back in. And then in the center you see a shoreland project which needs some help with getting a more stabilization basically to that site to prevent wave and other erosion from occurring. And here's a couple of examples. A lot of these practices are complementary. Some landowners and landowners have more than one of these practices on their property. You can see the upper left there is riparian buffers along the stream corridor in this case. In the lower left, we have these great stabilization and flood control projects to try and hold water and prevent downstream flooding, and we do get some flood storage in these structures as well. And they have, in this case, maybe not so much, but in some cases they do have some ancillary habitat benefits too. If you've got some open water, you get some aquatic communities established. In the lower right, the contour cropping, not near the water necessarily, but managing the rainfall that comes off that land. And in the upper right, conservation tillage, you can see there that practice, it's not a project, you've got to do it every year. A practice is something you have to kind of do over and over again. They've left that debris in the field and still been able to grow a very sound crop in that case. It also preserves moisture for the soil, so we don't have to worry about quite so much irrigation or other management of that site. And then in the center there you see a bioretention project along the lake shore, which many of these are being undertaken, but there's many, many more that are needed. Drainage, I want to just highlight this a little bit. Many know that in some parts of the state we've had a lot of altered hydrology for the purpose of moving the water off the land to make it more productive. A couple of years ago there was a drainage work group established, and we've been leading that since then, and they've recommended policy changes about every other year. And Mr. Chairman, we expect that we will have some language or bill that will be coming forward for this committee to consider in the near future on that topic again. We've also looked at getting some grants in the hands of these drainage authorities to modernize their record keeping, because it's a very, in some ways, complicated process to keep track of all the benefits and damages on these projects and make sure that they're keeping up with their resources they need to manage these systems over time. Here's just a couple of examples of that. This map shows on a statewide basis the red areas are kind of where we've got the channelized streams that really are, in many cases, considered public ditches now. Some of them are maybe full of private management, but the public ditches are run by either the counties or the watershed districts in the state, and they have a very specific statute, Minnesota Statute 103E, which describes how that gets done. Certainly going forward, we know that we need to do more to help those systems contribute to flood reduction and water quality improvements as well. And here we've got a case of a riparian buffer that is along a ditch system in the lower right, but one in the upper left that's needing some improvement. We also have some more innovative efforts underway to design systems that can, mimic some of the benefits of natural systems a little bit more. That sinuosity in the channel here, you can see, helps slow the water down, and having that vegetative channel with the bank helps it improve the water quality as well. But it also maintains the base flow that is in a system in a sinuous channel. And then when the flooding or high water comes along, we've got more volume available above that base flow to move the water out of there as quickly as we need to. We also have the State Soils Agency, and we have a soils office that we've established in joint fashion with the University of Minnesota. And that office does a lot of technical analysis and recommendations to how to manage our soil resource. I would highlight, that in the recent issue of National Geographic, and we know that our soil is going to be important going forward and for food as it's always been, but I think even more so perhaps for energy as we go forward into the future. So we need to make sure we take care of our soil. It takes 500 years to create an inch of topsoil, and we've got in Minnesota a very, very precious resource that I sometimes think is undervalued. We've got some of the highest quality soils in the country, the most productive soils. You see that picture in the upper right there, those three little plants that are growing out of those test tubes. That study was done to evaluate the productivity losses in soil due to compaction. If we're not careful with our equipment, not just in agriculture areas, but in our urban communities too, when we develop land, often the soil is sort of trodden upon without some sense of what it's going to be used for in the future. We end up with compacted soil that has much diminished capacity to what it was originally able to accomplish. And, of course, the erosion potential and soil sensitivity are important pieces about where we target projects and practices to make sure we're getting the most benefit for those dollars. The Clean Water Legacy, and I know our sister agency, PCA, will talk more about this, but this is an important piece of what we've been doing with our local governments, managing the game plan for how we get these water quality improvements accomplished. And again, this goes back to a watershed issue. This is a place where, again, Dakota County, where I previously worked, and we had this Lake Bilsby, major county park recreation area, but it was the very downstream end of that system practically, and so we knew that managing and improving that system was going to require a larger watershed approach. And you can't just manage a system like this without working with many others. this is probably pretty basic, but you know that land practices lead to the water quality issues, and the nutrient loading and sedimentation were two of the contributing elements to that Lake Bilsby situation. But it comes from a large area way upstream. A couple of project examples. These are just two that were randomly picked, but you can see that there are, if you look at the types of projects and then the funding in there, there are funds that come from not just state but federal and local sources too to contribute to some of these projects. And that's one of the things that we push a great deal, and those plans are really purposefully driven towards, is getting a combination of funding to get projects accomplished. One of the things that, you know, has been happening much more in our urban areas in particular, but elsewhere in the rural communities too, is in the past, not just the, you know, here in the urban situation where we tried to always move the water off the land as much as we could, as fast as possible, you know, the theme has been to try and keep it more on site. And here's a couple of examples of rain gardens. You know, they don't work everywhere because you got to have the right amount of land and the right configuration and the right soil types to make it work. But there are some benefits. You get more infiltration and less runoff. We have fewer pieces of infrastructure to build, you know, the hard pipes and things like that. Maintenance is a different kind of maintenance, and, you know, it may not be any less, but it's a different kind of more dispersed maintenance effort. And you can see in the lower right-hand side there is an analysis that was done to show the amount of water that was retained on site, you know, before they built this project, and then the amount that was benefiting after the fact. And you can see that quite a bit of water was able to stay on the site. Mind you, it's a small site, but collectively you add these up and they make a large difference over a watershed. Our Reinvest Minnesota program has been around for about 20 years now, 23 years, I guess, to be exact. And it's focused on wetland restorations and riparian buffers. Here's a couple of different wetland restorations. Some of them have permanent storage, some have temporary storage, some have drought capability, but all of them are focused on the wetland restoration and the habitat you get from that, as well as the upland grassland and prairie restorations that are accompanying those sites. The lower picture there actually shows one where we restored a wetland along a public ditch, which was one of the first that was ever done, where we were able to work with the drainage authority and the landowners to allow them to get sufficient drainage, but in a particular spot we were able to restore a wetland to get some storage and water quality benefits midway into that system. And so I think we're going to want to try and do many more projects like this in the years ahead. Here's one that's not yet done, but it's down in Carver County. It's an area that's been farmed since the 20s. And it's been, they had a pump to make this land farmable most years, and so this is a site now that we've acquired with a partnership with U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, and we've got a partnership now to restore this wetland, and the outlet will be restored back to a natural outlet that was just outside the Lake Waconia area here in the city of Waconia. The right-hand side there shows a USGS scientific analysis that was done this past year, completed this past year, which shows the water quality improvements of land retirement in critical areas. In this case, the IVI score, what that is an index of biological integrity. Rather than measuring the chemical parameters of water, you know, the phosphorus and so forth, they actually measure the macroinvertebrates and the health of those macroinvertebrate communities as a bellwether of larger, you know, water quality gains or losses. And so we think that was a pretty important assessment that was done there. A couple of the highlights, we've worked with the Camp Ripley in central Minnesota to acquire easements around their military facility and do conservation on those. They need to have some space around their facility to be able to operate fully in the future. We've also taken on some monitoring responsibilities to make sure our sites are up to quality we expect. And we've also worked with legislation that was passed last year to allow adjustments to those easements to allow biofuel and seed production to be used as a benefit beyond the habitat and water quality benefits on those sites. Here's that site around Camp Ripley. You can see that Ripley is the main area in the middle, and they've worked. They've got a plan that describes where they want to pursue a conservation easement to preserve their use of that site long term for military operations. And we've done analysis of our sites to make sure that the quality of those sites that we've constructed over the years is up to par or better. And where it isn't, we've had to now a chance to go back with some special language in last year's session to upgrade some of those sites and enhance them where needed. And I mentioned the biofuel production and the native seed production off of some of these lands is going to be critical to build that base of seed that we can use to hopefully establish more and more of these same high-quality plant communities. We recently put together a restoration strategy in partnership with the other agencies mentioned there, DNR, PCA, MnDOT, and the Department of Agriculture, to prioritize where our wetland restoration should occur in the state. We've used information like the CRP lands that are already in place and targeting the most critical of those for preservation as well as other areas for wetland restoration. You can see there in the map in the lower middle shows a habitat-based prioritization. We also have been working on more targeted things like this project here, which shows, if you look at the map on the right, we've got various restorable wetlands that have been identified in the Chippewa River watershed here in Swift County. And those that are in red have both a high water quality benefit as well as a high wildlife benefit. So we can kind of target for a couple of different functions using these tools that have been recently put together. In your packet there is a, you know, we've done some analysis to identify in our riparian areas, you know, we need buffer installations in some places in a pretty big way. You can see on a county-by-county basis there's a list of the streams, wetlands, and lakes that have buffers and those that do not within that 50 foot immediately adjacent to that water body. Now I have to put a plug in the lower left for LIDAR, a very critical piece of data that we use and our local governments use and use it every single day where we have it to be much more efficient and cost effective and precise about the analysis we do to plan, you know, both where we're going to put projects and also how we're going to make assessments of the landscapes for modeling purposes. It's a very important and useful tool. Multiple benefit projects is going to be something that we're going to be, I think, talking a lot more about. Riparian buffers and wetland restorations have quite a large list of public benefits. And you're familiar with many of these, I'm sure. I didn't bring Representative Junkie's Grass Lake project, so I couldn't get it together, but I will bring it to him next week because I'm going to see him. But some of these projects take, you know, many years because they're very large. That one, you know, by Wilmer is a big drained lake outside of Wilmer. It's about nearly 1,000 acres, the whole thing. We've been working on it for about, I think, 8 or 9 years and very close to now being ready to go. This is a smaller scale project here on a stream where you've got a channel. This is up in, and Representative Viking probably knows a little bit about this, but there's a project up there where they've got but with more or less a ditch now being re-meandered to bring back the channel sinuosity and the habitat in the channel. And then you see downstairs, and there's an easement that is taken over this whole wide area, and we're looking at doing many more of these kinds of things up in the Red River Valley and elsewhere. You look downstream, and there's a wetland restoration also. I couldn't quite get it all in the picture, but that wetland restoration also has an adjustable outlet, so it can be left full, and then it can be lowered in the fall, late fall, and it can be used for flood control purposes as well. So it's a managed system, but it much more replicates what nature once had on the landscape as well. And then a couple things we didn't plan on. This is one of them, but we were able to help with the flood down in the southeast that occurred August and a half ago. You can see that the flood events that everyone heard about there that we had a special session to deal with. One of the major projects that got done was a site in Minnesota City there where you can see where the damages to those homes occurred in the river system. And now you see a lot of rock here, which is sometimes what you have to do to prevent future damage. But we've also, since then, there's been a project to get the vegetation established above that critical area where the flood event needs to be managed with the armoring. But in this case, the USDA and our staff and the local staff put together this project in record time with funding from multiple sources. And here's kind of what happened, if you're curious. These two creeks come together, Rolling Stone and Governor Brook. I know Representative Grzeskowski's been in too many meetings about what happened, but Certainly the flood went a different direction than what the human engineering had planned, and certainly it didn't happen because of bad engineering. It happened because of debris that no one could have counted on impacting the way that water flowed. And you can see these systems here got choked with major debris, and the building had debris not just here but all these streams. It's a major effort to restore the habitat and also the flood volume management of those systems over the last year and a half. And there's many more of these smaller projects in a watershed. As you can imagine, you go upstream, you know, that flooding event was down there in Minnesota City right along the Mississippi River. If you go up into the landscape, and you know, a lot of these smaller watersheds experience damage as well. And here's just one example of a small 400 acre watershed where they had to do a structural repair to get that site back to where it needed to be. Just a little bit about accountability. We have a statutory responsibility to oversee the programs that we provide as well as the overall performance of our local governments. That was the recent statute passed in 2007. And you can see there on the left we have, you know, this performance review and assistance program. We'll have a chance to come and talk with you about that at some point, I'm sure, down the road, because we have a legislative report that is required. But we do a systematic review of a limited number of our local governments each year to make sure they're organizationally and operationally ready to go. We also have a mechanism in place to track all these projects. This happens to be Representative Eakin's district. We'd be able to pull out the data to show where the projects are, and you can see there's kind of a summary of the amount of funding and various sources that went into those projects. And we'll have a chance to tell you a little bit more about this when you visit our offices later in the week. And we have to make sure we get the results of what these projects were intended for. You can see there on the left there's a number of different kinds of projects, which I showed you a few examples of earlier. And then we tie that to, you know, these estimates of pollutant reductions in this case. This is just one example of that. And we have developed this system in partnership with the other agencies, and our local governments use this to report the results of their projects. Finally, we held this whole new constitutional amendment. There was certainly a water quality and a habitat component to that that some of you may be involved in down the road and making decisions on. But we held a round of listening sessions with a number of local governments and others that showed up at these in the month of December. And this is just a snapshot of some of the comments that the local governments and a few citizens and agency folks that were there provided some input on. So we can share more of that detail with you at some point if you're interested. And finally, a few trends and challenges we thought we would share with you. Certainly the technology use is a critical thing. We're using that more and more, and our local governments are ready to use it more and more to save time, to do better analysis, and to be more precise about what kinds of projects and practices we need and where. We know that more collaboration and mentoring and across boundaries is really important to share the resources we have, that limited as they always are, and to manage on a watershed approach is really an important aspect of that going forward. On the negative side, you know, we know that fewer people are directly connected to the land, it seems, you know, especially in our rural populations, they're diminishing. However, on a positive trend, we see more local and citizen participation and ownership in conservation and clean water than we've ever seen before. The issue of soil productivity and sustainability for the future of our food and energy, question mark, I guess, is the way we describe that. We're not sure if we've got enough commitment to preserving our soil resource. We know that it's important. We know that it provides those two primary functions, and we need to maybe pay more attention to that going forward. I mentioned multiple benefit projects, and the leveraging of federal funds and efforts are going to be important things that we pay attention to, not only this year, but going forward. And finally, I was reading over the holiday, just picked up this old book again, and was reading back into there, and many of the things that we're doing today in clean water and conservation were things that were prescribed and identified back in the 40s and earlier, and I think we just now have an opportunity to get going and make much more of that happen in the landscape. Thank you for your time. I'll take any questions now. We look forward to seeing you on our offices next Thursday. Or this Thursday, I'm sorry.
That's right. That's right. Thank you. And Representative Valdinius.
You talked about soil erosion and how we need to protect it. Do you have charts that show us what the patterns have been over the years how much we're losing, like last year compared to 1930, 1940, 1950. Do you have it, that tracking?
Director Jasky.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McGinnis, I don't have it on my fingertips, but I can certainly track that for you. Yes, we are, the U.S. Department of Agriculture does a good deal of sampling. We have something called the Natural Resources Inventory, and I'll check with them and see what kind of data they have. But they do a statistical sampling, and soils are one of the things they're measuring, soil health.
And Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Can I follow up?
Sure.
In general, are we doing better? Are we doing worse? Or are we flat? Are we still losing a lot of soil?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius
is asking.
Yes, we are losing soil. I think some of the questions are not only that we're losing the soil, but what's in the soil that's being lost, because of course it's coming off the surface. We're also losing soil in the river system themselves, you know, having bank erosion and things like that. So one of the challenges is to separate that in-stream erosion from the, you know, on-the-field erosion. We're doing a better job than we ever have, though, of preserving that soil. You saw that conservation tillage picture. That has been on the rise consistently since about the late 1980s, would be my estimate. That conservation tillage has become the norm because it's cheaper for the producer to operate that way. So I'm confident it's getting better. I just can't tell you how much better at this point.
And Representative Wagenius.
Just two more questions. How many of your board members are from the metro area?
Representative Wagenius. By statute, we have to have a geographic distribution of board members. I'm gonna say at least three or four, but I'll have to look at the map again to make sure. And if you define a 7-county or 11-county, that'd be another factor. But the map that was in the packet shows where each of them is located. I'd have to go back and look at that.
Okay. And we'll just check on that later.
Yep.
The last question, you talked about your sprayers going after reed canary grass. Is it still allowed to be planted in Minnesota? It's a horrible invasive.
Chairman, our state policy is that reed canary grass is not part of any of our programs or projects.
The real question is, are other people allowed to buy it and plant it, or have we said this is not a good deal and nobody can buy it and plant it?
It's not illegal under state law to have or possess or use reed canary grass, but any of the state program projects and practices we are involved with, it is prohibited.
The reason I'm concerned about this, when people are planting this, and then it takes a lot of public taxpayer dollars then to turn around and get rid of it, because it's just, in any restoration, it's just terrible stuff.
Well, and we know that it is still allowed, but how much is it being used? Is it are landowners using it? I don't know if you have any information in regard to that. Representative Falk, you?
I know that we sell it to farmers for purposes of grazing, so they use it for baling for livestock or for feed purposes.
Okay. So, and I believe Representative Gardner was first. Or did you have a question to this point, Representative Drzaskowski?
Actually, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment to the point. It's used quite a bit in northern part of Minnesota, especially. There are some soils that that don't have fertility to support some of our other agronomic crops, and really to yank this away from farmers, especially in that part of the state, would yank away one of the very important tools in their agronomic practices.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had two questions. One is, can we access this e-link off your website? Is it publicly available, or do we need a GIS guru to figure it out?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, we just upgraded the system to be, it's fully web-based now, so all the users of it, all you need to have is web access. It is protected by, you know, username and password. We're, at some point, we're interested in building a public portal into that data. Right now, it's limited to the users of local governments who put the data in, as well as our, you know, experts internally. But if you are interested in specific reports or outputs, we can work on that At some point, we'll have a more public component to it.
Just as a follow-up, that would be helpful. I know the PCA has integrated a lot of data, so you can look up contaminated sites around the state pretty well with public information, and I was able to do that with the drinking water stuff, too, with some of the Mid-Council reports. The other question I had is, how would you characterize the follow-up to the legislative auditor's report from 2 years ago, I guess, on the things like the governance of watershed districts and watershed management or water management organizations? Have they gotten better in their governance structure, worse, about the same?
Mr. Gardner, I mentioned that oversight provision that was added in statute that same year of Minnesota Statute 103B.102, which requires us to do a systematic and overview of those organizations and their performance against their plans that they are expected to put in place. We will give you a report on that at some point down the road if you're interested in that. Certainly. The other thing that was put in that statute is some consequences if certain things aren't met, and that is another provision that I think they're well aware of. It also puts a burden on us to assist them where they need some assistance, and we'll talk about that as well. So I certainly believe that we've gotten made great strides in that, and just being systematic to begin with, I think, was the most important part of it.
Thank you. Any other questions? What's going to pay more?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm new to the committee, so forgive my ignorance. So who appoints the board members? I don't.
Mr. Chair, the governor appoints those members.
Okay. And then I just have a final question. Are we seeing fewer farmers or ag land being participating in the CREP program?
Director Jaskey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, the CREP program was a partnership that we established with the U.S. Department of Agriculture a number of years ago. What we've now moved on to is another partnership with our RIM and the Wetland Reserve Program. But that's a very good question because I believe we're going to have opportunities to go back to something very similar to that in the future. But we always have to balance the public benefits and the private interests, and we've made that original CREP program very attractive to landowners, and we had the resources to pull it off. The second version of that was less successful because it wasn't attractive to landowners as it was the first time. So we need to make sure we keep their perspective primary in that program if we put another one of those together.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure you answered my question. Are we seeing, less involvement in by the ag community in the CREP program?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, we had a sign up this past June. In 3 weeks, we signed up landowners, and we had to turn many away that will restore 9,800 and some odd acres of wetland, and those were all on private lands, and those landowners stepped forward and were very interested, and we were only able to fund about a third of them, so we believe there's very strong interest.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
And Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to thank you, Mr. Jaskey, and your agency for the work you did with the flood down in the southeast. Your agency did a great job. I appreciate the help, especially in articulating a lot of the work around that Minnesota City project. And look forward to hopefully you and the watershed districts being involved in some of the 3-ACE Amendment money. I think that's a wonderful fit for your organizations.
Thank you. And Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Jaskey, could you just explain a little bit about any partnerships that you may have currently with the DNR or other agencies with regard to management of invasive species, in particular knapweed, loose strife, some of those, but in general?
Director Jaskey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Saylor, we have a new endeavor that was funded in 2007. It's a weed cooperative, and it's based on a county. And we had one of them in Clay County that was already established, and we've now established, I think, about 12 or 15 of them via these grant program. What that cooperative is the locals, the state, the federal government, as well as even some private donations from companies that produce the chemicals. They do a invasive species control in a cooperative fashion because these invasive species don't know if it's public, federal land, public, local land, road right-of-way, or private land, and they can go out and, with this cooperative, tackle these invasive species problems collectively, and that's been very successful with very limited funding, and so we hope to be doing more of that going forward.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, I would like to thank you, Director Jasky, as well, and I do feel that you and Bowser are in a key position here in coordinating the efforts between the watersheds and the soil, the SWCDs and the counties, and I know it's a difficult task sometimes, coordinating all of those different units, but another key position is dealing with that 78% of the private landowners out there, and we're never going to achieve the goals that we set in terms of clean water or preserving our soils if we don't reach out to those private landowners. And I too think that some of the new money that we may be receiving at the state level could be well utilized for the purposes of incentives for private landowners as well to participate in programs that would help us achieve our goals that we've set as a state. So thank you, Director Jasky. And next we're going to be moving on to the Acting Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency, Commissioner Paul Egger. And if you would state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Paul Egger. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency. And just a minor correction to your agenda, I'm actually the Temporary Commissioner, which... I had never heard that title until Commissioner Moore left and found out by statute when the commissioner leaves and the deputy is asked to step in to fulfill the role of commissioner, it's by statute temporary commissioner.
Okay.
Anyone else would be acting, but the roles and responsibilities are the same. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. And I just want to echo Mr. Jashke's remarks regarding this Thursday in your site visit. We are co-located with Bowser and in the same complex as the Department of Natural Resources, and we're looking forward to hosting the committee and showing you around our offices and having a good discussion on Thursday night. So thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, since there are quite a few new members, I just thought I'd cover a few items to give you a sense of the agency, our organization and structure. Also, focus on our strategic plan, vision, and some of the key goals that are contained in our strategic plan. And also highlight a few of the key outcomes that you'll be hearing more about as the session progresses. And finally, identify for the committee some challenges and at the same time some opportunities that we have coming up in the environmental area.
Excuse me, Representative Cornish has a question.
Mr. Chair, rather than ask a question, I just wanted you to cover this in your regular comments, if you could, and the burning permit issue with the local fire departments, if you could cover that in your regular course. Sometime hit on it. A lot of complaints from the fire departments that you folks are getting so rough on them, they can't have training burns anymore in the issuance of these permits, so inspections and this and that and the rulemaking requirements. So.
Commissioner Egger?
Although I know little about that, Representative Cornish, I'll do my best to try to address that at the end of my comments. Thank you for bringing that issue up. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's mission is to work with Minnesotans to protect, conserve, and improve our environment and enhance our quality of life. And I just want to emphasize the concept of working with Minnesotans. Certainly state agencies, local units of government, various advocacy organizations have their role and responsibilities, but we also, as citizens of the state, have a responsibility as well to conserve and protect the environment, and the Pollution Control Agency relies on partnerships with local units of government, with our sister agencies, the federal government, and citizens to accomplish this mission. Before I get into the organization structure of the Pollution Control Agency, I did want to focus for just a couple of minutes on our governments and some of the key partnerships that the agency utilizes to accomplish its work. We do have a citizens board, And the Citizens Board is established in statute. The members are appointed by the governor and Senate confirmable, and the commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency is the chair of the Citizens Board. And the Citizen Board's role is to set policy and direction for the agency, as well as to take action, be the decision-making body for significant or controversial environmental and compliance issues. The Pollution Control Agency is also a key partner of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. The MPCA carries out the responsibility for permitting, and much of the work that the EPA is charged with doing as a delegated state. For example, carrying out the National Pollutant Discharge and Elimination System permits, the NPDES permit program for water quality. And we're also partners in the state Superfund program, which also there's a federal Superfund program, and the state works closely with EPA to clean up those sites that are Superfund sites. We also do the air permitting, which is also referred to as the Title V permitting program in Minnesota on behalf of the federal government. We also have important relationships with our sister agencies, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, as Mr. Jaschke pointed out. We have a number of areas of common concern and common priorities, and the Pollution Control Agency sits as a member on the Bowser Board. DNR, in addition, is a key partner, and where these partnerships play out most obviously are in the area of the Clean Water Legacy Act and our coordination on not only implementing the policy direction that the legislature enacted in 2006, but also coordinating the development of budget recommendations and responding to questions from the legislature on how that work all fits together and how the results are delivered. In addition, like many of the state agencies within your committee jurisdiction, Mr. Chairman, there are a number of other advisory groups, councils such as the Clean Water Council, that provide very valuable feedback, input, suggestions for the Pollution Control Agency in carrying out our work. Mr. Chairman, the Pollution Control Agency consists of staff, over 900 staff, located in 8 offices throughout the state. And you see on the map where our 8 offices are located. In addition, we're organized as a matrix organization. I'll just explain real briefly what each of our divisions is responsible for. We have 8 divisions. The industrial division is where the core regulatory programs that ensure larger industrial facilities comply with air quality, water quality, and hazardous waste regulations. Those responsibilities are carried out by our industrial division. The regional division is where many, if not most, of our environmental programs, products, and services are delivered in terms of feedlots, watershed organizations, and individuals. And the regional division is also our lead agency in the development of total maximum daily load plans, or TMDLs, which are the cleanup plans associated with the impaired waters activities in the Clean Water Legacy Act. The municipal division, Mr. Chairman, is the division that works with cities and towns to ensure the proper management of wastewater, stormwater, and solid waste to help protect the environment and our citizens. And this division works closely with the Public Facilities Authority to review the plans and specifications for new wastewater facilities that are going to require wastewater permits, and that the PSC is the financial agent for it in delivering grant and loan funds. We also have Prevention and Assistance Division, which provides pollution prevention, environmental education, and technical and financial assistance to partners throughout the state. Our Remediation Division operates programs that clean up pollution in soil and water from accidental spills or other activities that occur over a long period of time. An example would be our Superfund program, and also our closed landfill cleanup program. The Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division monitors and evaluates the physical, chemical, and biological conditions of the environment. This is where our water quality assessment for the purposes of measuring our water quality against state water quality standards, is located where that service is performed, and also our air quality monitoring, just to name a couple of key functions. Operational Support Division is our accounting and financial management division. Also, our human resources services are operated out of the Operational Support Division. And we have a data performance and management division that develops and maintains agency data management systems and leads our continuous improvement efforts and organizational development activities. And also, a key function of this division, Mr. Chairman, is advancing our sustainability objectives in terms of reducing our impact as an agency on the environment, also assisting our sister agencies and even the House of Representatives in ways that we can reduce our use of printed paper, for example, or other ways in which we impact the environment. So our sustainability activities are housed in that division. And in the commissioner's office, we have three assistant commissioners. And as I mentioned, we're a matrix organization where we're based, our divisions are based by function, and our assistant commissioners are media-based, and their responsibility is to oversee the policy aspects by media, air, water, land, and pollution prevention, and to also provide that oversight in terms of making sure that across divisions we're coordinating by media so that water activities and programs and services that are delivered out of, say, industrial division or municipal division or regional division, that there's sound coordination amongst those divisions where appropriate. Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to highlight a few of our key goals for each of our vision areas in our strategic plan, just to give the committee a sense of our priorities and the areas we're focusing on. And I'll start with air, and the vision is that Minnesota's air is clean and clear. And I put up on the slide a couple of examples of key goals in the strategic plan. And Minnesota does currently meet all federal Clean Air Act standards for the six key air pollutants, and those would be sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, particles, ozone, carbon monoxide, and lead. But as members of the committee probably are aware, we still have several days each year that are unhealthy for sensitive groups, and that you'll see air quality alerts in the newspaper and the media. So although Minnesota is meeting those federal standards or exceeding them, there's still work to do in the area of improving our air quality, and we do see several days each year that trigger those alerts and that require some additional work on our part. Just an example of some of the key activities or the key program components in air quality would be our permitting program and the point for large industrial sources. That's permitting, compliance, and enforcement. The monitoring of air quality and the AQI is the air quality index, which is how we communicate that information. And also the development and implementation of strategies to reduce regional and global air pollutants, including emissions that contribute to climate change. Mr. Chair, in the water area, the vision is that Minnesota has clean, sustainable surface and groundwater. And you'll see that in the example goals, we do have a representation of assessment of both our surface and groundwater quality. And we also recognize the need to develop and implement protection and restoration plans throughout the state by a watershed basis. Now, I'll touch on that in a later slide. The water program consists of several elements, and again, we have our permitting, compliance, and enforcement functions. We also have the monitoring and assessment of our water resources. And again, we also want to focus on the development of restoration plans, and those are the total maximum daily load plans for when we identify an impaired water. But we also want to protect high-quality waters via a watershed approach so that we're able to implement practices and before a water body is actually at the state where we would have to list it as impaired and implement a whole restoration strategy. As you all probably know, it's a lot more, it's a lot less expensive to prevent something from happening than to have to remediate the problem after it's occurred. In the land area, our vision is Minnesota's land supports desired uses. And in this area, a few of our key goals are getting at the idea that we need to make sure that all waste generated in Minnesota are handled and disposed of properly, that we prevent future contamination, and that we're also cleaning up areas where waste have not been properly handled. And again, many of these are legacy sites that may even have predated the creation of the Pollution Control Agency. And Mr. Chairman, in this graphic, you can see on the left-hand side of the slide the land components, and these are some of the programmatic activities in the land area, Superfund, closed landfills, petroleum remediation, etc. And on the right side, you'll see the outcomes, and there are a variety of outcomes that are achieved through these programs, and many of them work in concert together. Through cleanup, you get to then the management level, and finally you want to implement some prevention strategies so that there isn't a cycle that's repeated over time. Mr. Chairman, in the 2005 session, the governor recommended in the legislature passed a combination of the Pollution Control Agency and the Office of Environmental Assistance and created a new department that housed these functions under the name of the Pollution Control Agency. One of the benefits of that combination was the addition of a lot of new tools to our toolbox in addressing the problems that we face as a state. And through that, we have a number of activities focused on prevention and assistance. And in the prevention and assistance area, we have a vision that Minnesotans take responsibility to protect our environment, which harkens back to the mission statement that we're addressing issues that require the expertise and the resources of the Pollution Control Agency, but there's a broader mission to engage the citizens of Minnesota and also playing a key role in protecting our environment. And within that prevention and assistance area, we have some key goals that we're actually providing knowledge to Minnesota citizens so that they can act in on that knowledge and support healthy ecosystems. It's an acknowledgement that if people have information, they generally make decisions that are beneficial to the environment. It doesn't mean that everyone starts at the same place. For example, a Prius can be practical for one person, but if you're carpooling to a soccer game, it's not going to be the practical vehicle for you. But if there's information available that provides citizens with the ability to make choices and to understand the implications of those choices for the environment, that's what we're trying to achieve with many of these prevention assistance activities. We also want to ensure that Minnesota businesses are able to produce green products.
Excuse me, Representative Leguinius had a question.
Thanks. If we are going to say that, and we all love the phrase that Minnesotans take responsibility to protect our environment, but that assumes that they know enough to do so. Have you projected out the cost of an education program that would get us to the place where Minnesotans protect our environment?
Mr. Commissioner Agger.
Representative Ogenius, you touched on a very key challenge in engaging our citizens, which is, what is the short answer to your question is, we don't have a cost projection that would be a reliable model to determine what it would cost to fully engage our citizens in this mission. I think it's an issue that we continue to focus on. How do we reach Minnesota Fire to make informed decisions? We have a number of methods that we use for outreach, but I wouldn't say that they're comprehensive in nature, and it's something that I think we're going to want to engage the legislature and some of those advisory groups in utilizing our citizens board to determine what are the costs and what are the opportunities to have a fully engaged citizenry. Right now, it's opportunity-based, I would say, that when we have an opportunity or it's a teachable moment, we take advantage of it. But there's more work to be done on a comprehensive strategy.
Representative Wilgenius.
Well, I just think about my constituents, and it would be ideal, of course, if every neighbor took responsibility for their own actions. And there are two things we don't know here. One is, would we ever be able to give everybody enough knowledge to do that? And secondly, if we gave them enough knowledge, would they act on it? So knowing that, I think lots of citizens depend on you to protect us. And they assume that you do it. Until we have, we know that we can have the money to educate everybody fully so that they do this, it does seem that you have a responsibility here.
Mr. Chairman.
You have certainly have a statutory responsibility to get the job done.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me be clear. This is by no means a substitute for the responsibilities of the Pollution Control Agency. This is a broadening of the toolbox, or the utilizing more tools than we had probably utilized in many years, and bringing the focus on engagement of our citizens to try to leverage some additional outcomes. It's not a substitute for the agency doing the traditional work that the agency by statute or by agreement with the federal government or by direction of the legislature has done. It's trying to broaden our ability to have a wider impact and a wider benefit to the environment. So I just want to make that clear. I'm not suggesting that we're deferring our responsibilities to the citizens. It's really trying to broaden the scope of our work and to bring in as many partners as we possibly can.
Representative Gardner.
Well, to that point, Mr. Chair, I was going to point out that the PCA, or the OEA, and now the PCA, is a really good tool for actually benchmarking knowledge. Their environmental literacy survey that's done, I don't know, every 3 years, maybe something like that, where it's a statewide statistically valid survey where people are asked about their awareness of proper land use, water quality, climate change, you name it. And maybe someone could email us the link and we could get it out, because it actually does tell you what people know or don't know, and you can measure it over time. What it would actually cost to get people up to the level that we'd like, I'm not sure we can put a number on that, but there certainly is benchmark data for that.
Mr. Chairman, our staff will get that link to you for distribution to your committee members. Thank you, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Temporary Commissioner.
I know it's an impressive title, Mr. Chair.
I wanted to be sure I got it.
To my head.
I wanted to get it right. This is kind of on the same point. I was wondering, you know, when you're talking about public education, bringing public awareness up, have you so far, you know, this year discussed any changes that might be made, for instance, in the program that is put on down at the State Fair? It's a wonderful display, actually, and there are a number of different agencies, I think, that also participate in that, and as well as some private. But what sorts of efforts have you contemplated for moving that sort of educational opportunity to other areas around the state? I mean, I recognize the fact that many people come to the state fair, so if you're doing this on just a strictly cost analysis for numbers, that might be the place. But there are large numbers of our citizens that are unable to attend just that sort of thing, and you have a number of resources that are pretty valuable, and I'm wondering what plans you may have for sharing that around the state.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, well, thank you for that question, because that's an exercise actually that we're conducting right now. I think the current state budget has resulted in a lot of opportunities for agencies to think about our work and what's working and what we should evaluate and how we can maybe do our job a little bit differently and have a broader impact. And as part of that effort, we are looking at, you're referencing the eco experience at the State Fair, which has been tremendously popular as far as the number of people that walk in the door and view the various displays and learn from the exhibits. What we're looking right now is that's been a model that we've utilized for several years now. Is it still achieving what we'd like it to achieve? And actually, getting back to an issue that Representative Wagenius, I know, is interested in is how we measure our outcomes. But one of the things that we found over the last couple of years and we've been working on is that the way we were measuring our outcomes in terms of the prevention and assistance area was by contact hours. For example, how many people were walking, you know, were visiting the eco experience. Well, that isn't particularly helpful. It's a head count, for sure, but it doesn't tell us what actions are being implemented, what impact is it having on the environment. So our staff is working hard to determine what the best measurements would be in the prevention assistance area. And it is a little bit more difficult than some of the regulatory programs. For example, cleaning up a Superfund site, you can measure that. You can see it. But it's a long answer to your question that we're looking at eco experience and what other opportunities statewide do we have to broaden the reach beyond St. Paul and those that visit the fair. In addition, we're finding the state isn't the only entity having budget trouble, local units of government, the private sector. We're just anticipating that travel is going to be as difficult for our other partners as it is for us, and so we want to make sure that we're taking advantage of all the opportunities that are out there, and that's going to mean maybe smaller events, but more dispersed throughout the state in order to reach that audience that we'd like to reach.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Eager, the mission component of MPCA to be involved in education, I guess my understanding of the agency was it was a regulatory agency. It seems that there's been a mission drift from where the mission was for the agency originally. Can you outline kind of where the authority is for the agency to go in that direction? I see a lot of redundancy with other efforts that are going on in a variety of places out there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, first of all, I think in order to deliver any regulatory service, they're not solely regulatory, and there's not an education can't be segregated. I think there's a component of education in just about everything we do as a state, and for certain as a state agency. But to your specific question about mission drift, the functions of the old Office of Environmental Assistance, which was primarily prevention, assistance, education, is the mission, and the Pollution Control Agency were combined under a single agency in 2005. The legislature enacted it. So it is part of our mission. But to your other point about mission drift, that's certainly something that we're taking a look at in terms of, and I'm skipping ahead, Representative Saylor's question also touched on a topic that I'm going to cover in a later slide. But one of the issues that we're looking at right now in terms of these tight budget times is what do we do as an agency, and what we need to be uniquely positioned to do, and we need to do it well. And so we're very conscious of, to use your terminology, the mission drift. But in terms of education, it's a critical component of any of the services we deliver, any of our responsibilities. There's, even in a regulatory approach, a permitting program, there's going to be some education that occurs, just like there's compliance and enforcement. It's not all one or all the other.
And we are reaching the end of the committee hearing time, so if we could maybe just continue on and ask any other questions at the end, that would be great.
Mr. Chairman, so I'll move quickly through the final couple of slides. So in the prevention assistance program, this would be where our recycling activities and promotion of recycling opportunities would be delivered. It's also in terms of waste prevention, where we work with both the units of government, with the business community, to develop a market for those recycled materials and products. And again, we one of our key partners is that on this effort is the counties, and we work with them on waste prevention disposal strategies. And this, again, is a primary area where education is a key component of how we deliver that benefit. In the air program, or in the air area, Mr. Chairman, I'm moving on to a few of the key outcomes that I just want to leave with the committee. The Project Green Flu, which has been a legislative priority as well over the last couple of years, nearly 1,000 school buses have been retrofit to date. And this is a partnership among businesses, government agencies, and nonprofit organizations to reduce the pollution emitted from Minnesota school buses and to protect children's health. We also have some key measurements in the area of greenhouse gas emissions, and this work has been a focus of the legislature for the last several years, as well as the agency. And many of you are probably familiar with Assistant Commissioner David Thornton, and we'll see him at the Capitol quite a bit responding to questions and discussing the progress that the state is making in terms of reduction of greenhouse gases in Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, on the water side, the key outcomes, I do want to just highlight a couple of items. And on the Clean Water Legacy Act, in the monitoring and assessment and the development of the total maximum daily load, or the cleanup plans, the MPCA is on track to meet the 2007 session targets that were established. And we worked with Representative Bohenius that asked a number of questions on outcomes and how we can measure those. And so in the assessment area, we'll be assessing the state's waters on a 10-year cycle and development of the total maximum daily load studies. It was approximately 10% of the studies completed each year. So essentially a 10-year cycle for both of those activities. And at this point, we are on target for both of those outcomes. And although Representative Hansen is not here, I do want to just recognize our appreciation for his work and the work of Senator Rust on the ballast water issue. The legislature did pass a bill last year that dealt with the submission of ballast water management plans to the agency, which Representative Hansen did a lot of work in pulling the various stakeholders together throughout the session, having discussions about the work of the agency and how that fit with the work of the legislature. And I just want to, although he's not here, just voice my appreciation for his assistance and the work that he did in that area. To this point, we do have 107 applications in-house. The shipping season has ended, and we expect approximately 200 permit applications to be submitted before the 2009 shipping season. And we're continuing our work with both our sister states like Wisconsin as well as the federal government to ensure that we have a coordinated approach and that that we're achieving the desired outcomes from the permit that we did implement. Also, just quickly, Mr. Chairman, to highlight a couple of key outcomes in the land area, the MPC is undertaking a broad range of efforts to better understand the presence of PFCs or perfluoroalkyl chemicals in the environment. And this is an area that we'll be talking about in different contexts of the legislature in terms of just the overall policy issues, but as well as the in our closed landfill programs, some of the cleanup issues associated with those legacy disposal of perfluoroalkyl chemicals. And again, those are a family of chemicals developed by the 3M company that have been used for decades to make products that resist heat, oil, stains, grease, and water. And Mr. Chairman, if the committee, if any of the committee members are interested at our MPCA Citizens Board meeting, which is a week from today, we're going to have our quarterly overview of the 3M consent decree and provide an update on the PSC issue for our citizens board. And we're also members of the committee, several members of the committee have been involved in the solid waste stakeholder process that is currently ongoing. Again, this is an effort that we're working with the Minnesota Environmental Initiative on, and its focus is to develop strategies to achieve the greenhouse gas reduction, energy conservation, and environmental protection through integrated solid waste management. Mr. Chair, real briefly, just a few of the challenges and opportunities that we have in the different media areas. In the air area, obviously climate change, the greenhouse gas emission issue is one that's going to be a challenge not only for Minnesota, but our other states as well as the federal government for years to come. So that's a challenge that we'll continue to be working on in the air area. And water, Clean Water Legacy Act, although we've been talking about, it feels like we've been talking about the Clean Water Legacy Act for such a long time, but in reality, the policy language was just implemented in 2006, and we're still in the relatively early stages of implementation. So there will be many lessons to learn and discussions that we'll have over here throughout this session and beyond as we implement those activities as a state. In the land area, again, trying to focus on where we can identify and help others identify waste as a resource, and also addressing some of these emerging issues in the land area, such as the disposal of chemicals like PFCs in the environment. And then just to tie back to the agency, to the questions that came up earlier regarding what we would do, how we can either build on or learn from the eco experience, and also the question about mission creep. We are looking as an agency at our at issues associated with sustainability, and it means not only our impact on the environment and how we can minimize that and help our sister agencies minimize their impacts on the environment, but it's also sustainability moving forward in delivering the key services and programs and outcomes that are expected of the agency, both in statute and the expectations of the legislature over time. And it is an examination of what is it that we're uniquely positioned to do as an agency, that we're charged to do. Are we doing it well? And if not, what do we need to do to direct the staff, support, resources in order to ensure that we're achieving the highest leverage environmental outcomes from those activities that we're uniquely positioned to offer? So it's a broader look at agency sustainability. It's a step back to try to examine how we're delivering our work, how we're doing our work, and what we can learn from past successes in areas where we haven't delivered to the extent that we should, and that the citizens of the state and the legislature expect us to deliver, and to make those adjustments where necessary. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll wrap up my presentation.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any other questions? Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple. Is it an agency position that they view carbon dioxide emissions as natural pollutant or not?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I would answer your question this way. The agency is working hard with a variety of stakeholders, with our states and the Midwest Governors Association area, with the legislature, to reduce the impacts of greenhouse gases as they contribute to climate change. In terms of defining carbon as a pollutant, that's an issue I'd have to go back and work with our Assistant Commissioner for Air and find out what his work is on that area. It's not an area that I've been involved in to date at this point. But our commitment to working collaboratively and seriously to address the impacts of CO2 on climate change, we're absolutely committed to that.
Thanks, Representative Falk.
So I guess the agency position is that climate change is real, as evidenced by carbon dioxide emissions. That is a truism?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely.
And then the other is, do you think we should take a proactive role when it comes to policy, or do you think we should take more of a wait-and-see approach?
Mr. Chairman, I actually don't think it's one or the other. I think one of the opportunities we have moving forward is that there are a lot of expectations of the actions that the Environmental Protection Agency is going to implement in the coming months, and in terms of climate change and a whole variety of issues that impact not just Minnesota, but the whole country. And so, you know, we're looking forward to the opportunity to engage EPA and find out what their plans are moving forward. And in those areas where the Environmental Protection Agency is going to work as a convener of the states on these issues that impact all of us, we're going to get further if we work that partnership. And in areas where they're not moving as quickly, and I would use for those of you that are on the ballast water issue as a prime example, EPA was working on this issue, but they weren't working as fast or in the direction that Minnesota wanted to see them, then we do need to stake out a position on our own. So I don't think it's one or the other. I think we're hopeful that the Environmental Protection Agency is gonna be a force that's going to help us all work in the same direction and leverage a better outcome than each state going individually, but we'll have to wait and see.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cornish's question. Representative Cornish, could you just clarify, you talked about the burn barrel issue, or are you referencing a different issue?
Training burns for Mr. Chairman and Stringer, the training burns for fire departments. They're complaining, several of them down there, that the restrictions got worse and worse every year till they were able now to, first it was inspections and then walkthroughs where they had to pay for and then stripping the building of all the materials before they could burn it. Now it's gotten so costly and time-consuming that they're, under the present conditions, they're just about outlawed totally, and they can't have practice burns anymore. And there's a place where they're supposed to write in for comments on rulemaking, and the question I had is whether you can just make that rule or if it has to go through the legislature or shut down burning totally, or how that's going.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not familiar with the specifics in this area, so I'll look into it, Representative Cornish, and get back to you. But in general, if we're delegated the authority by the legislature to go through rulemaking, any rule wouldn't come back to the legislature. But I don't know the specifics on this issue. I'll certainly look into it, and Mr. Chairman, I'll get back to Representative Cornish directly and share that with your staff. So if any other members of your committee are interested in the status of that.
Okay. Thank you. And go ahead, Representative Cornish.
One of the things, if you could have the young woman get back to me, she's a government relations person for you, about Drummer landscaping. There's been a long gap of information.
Okay.
Representative, Mr. Chairman, she is writing that down, and we'll send that back to you.
Representative Hackbright?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted that same information. Okay. That's going to go to Representative Cornish.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, we are, thank you, Commissioner Egger, for coming here today. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman, and we'll see you on Thursday.
That sounds great, and I was just going to mention, for Thursday, we will be having the tour, and we're going to be sending out information by email right after this committee, so, and I will give directions as well, which is very simple. Just go out to university, take a right, and go down about a mile down to the end of university, and that's where it's located. So, again, we'll see you on Thursday. With that, meeting is adjourned.